This podcast is part of Mishmash Media. Hello, folks.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. Welcome to another episode of Curbcast. My name's Ivan.
And I'm Stephen.
And we are up to episode 6 of our podcast, where we review every episode of Curb Your Enthusiasm in chronological order, scene by scene. And we're doing an episode which is also happens to be a HBO show as well. It's called The Wire.
Yeah, a bit different than the actual Wire.
I thought it was going to be like a crossover episode, you know, Larry goes to Baltimore.
Usually crossover episodes are, you know, once a show is 10 or 12 years old and they're running low on ideas.
True.
This is halfway through the first season.
Yeah, yeah. They just crossover both shows.
I wouldn't have much confidence in the show after this if they're already doing crossovers.
Yeah. Omar and Larry become mates, you know, before Omar's tragic death.
I can imagine Larry going into Baltimore and just questioning the cops and all the, you know, all the grim shit that you see in The Wire.
Ah, yeah. The politicians.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I think it'd make some bad situations worse.
Yeah, but it'd be like comedy though.
Yeah.
For some reason or somehow. But anyway, we are doing The Wire. And this is the first episode, Steve, where a cast member from Seinfeld, like a main cast member, makes an appearance. Our favorite, JLD, Julia Louis-Dreyfus, makes her debut in Curb.
Yeah, and she actually has quite a important role in the episode. And after this, they, you know, at least a couple of times per season, there's always an appearance. I know Jason Alexander appears, JLD appears a lot in season 2.
That's right. Anyway, shall we get stuck into it?
Before we do, just wanted to mention that we do have social media. You can check us out on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, and Reddit at CurbCastPod. We do have an email address as well, CurbCastPod@gmail.com. We do have a Facebook group as well. It's called Curb Your Enthusiasms. Bit confusing. but yeah, just type in Curb Your Enthuse. And it should come up in the search bar.
Yeah, there's only about 3,200 people at the moment, but it's slowly growing.
Yeah, slowly but surely. So if you want to contribute to that growth, join the fun.
Indeed. Anyway, The Wire first aired in the US on HBO on the 19th of November 2000. Cheryl gives Larry an ultimatum: bury the wire in the backyard or else. But the permit the city gives Larry requires 6 signatures from his neighbors, and that means having to be nice to all of them at all costs or else. I like that. Scene 1. Jeff is on the phone in his office as Larry is scribbling on a notepad. He tells Larry that his kid that he sponsors got in trouble at summer camp as he set fire to the canteen and his cabin. Oh boy, he's a very, very troubled boy, this one.
Yeah, it seems like he needs a lot of time at camp to help his demons out.
Yeah, or prison, one of the two, juvie.
Yeah. Well, hopefully the camp can be, you know, an intervening factor to prevent him from going to prison, you know.
Yeah, to prevent recidivism.
Yeah, yeah. You know, the old sort of streets to prison pipeline is usually helped by, you know, early intervention and therapy and stuff. So,
yeah.
Yeah, so, but it sounds like he needs something something needs to change in his life.
And I love it when Larry's like, oh, that kid's a pyromaniac. No, that Jeff says he's a pyromaniac and Larry's like, he's the wrong kind of maniac. Could be a kleptomaniac. Could be something else. Pyro is the worst one.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's the worst. Larry sarcastically says that Jeff tries to do good things and they backfire. No pun intended. Jeff says that he'll talk to the kid and see why he did it. Jeff's secretary walks in to tell Larry that Cheryl was on the phone asking him to come home. Larry explains the story to Jeff that they need a wire above their property buried underground and that they need all 6 neighbor couples to approve it. So he's in a bit of a pickle because, I mean, for Larry, he doesn't really care about the wire, we find out later. But Cheryl, she's really, I don't know, she doesn't like the aesthetic of it.
Yeah, I mean, she says a bit later on the episode that it's the one thing that's preventing the house from being perfect. I can understand why it would be annoying if you love every aspect of your house and the view and, you know, every part of it, but just one little thing. If there were a number of issues with the house, you'd just kind of accept it and go, well, you know, nothing's perfect. But if it's the one thing preventing it from being everything you want, I can understand. I think Cheryl's a bit too obsessive about it, and I can understand Larry's reluctance. It's like, meh, who cares?
Yeah.
But I've been in that situation where there's just one thing that's wrong with whatever the situation is, and you become obsessive about it, you know, you get fixated. So I kind of understand both people's, you know, Cheryl's determination and Larry's sort of, you know, indifference or reluctance, you know, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, I mean, Larry just doesn't want to do anything about it.
Like, no,
to him, he doesn't care.
He doesn't really care.
Nah. No. But it's more for Cheryl, and obviously he's got to, you know, satisfy his wife.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's a nice thing to do for her, but she is very, very insistent throughout the episode.
Oh, she is. She's like, do it or else, like
basically.
I said in the synopsis.
Yeah.
Back at home, Cheryl and Larry are waiting for the last couple to approve the wire work. They're coming over to sign the paperwork and look at the wire. They answer the door to them. The couple are named Dean and Phyllis. Phyllis says that she's happy to be in the house that Jerry Seinfeld built. And I love it because it's like a throwback to Porno Gil, our favorite episode so far. You know, when Gil says it's the house that Cum built.
The house
I like it. It was like a pseudo kind of...
I
Throwback, yeah.
Yeah.
The house that Jerry Seinfeld built.
If I was Larry, I'd be slightly insulted because, I mean, you know, Jerry is a big reason why Seinfeld is successful and he was one of the co-creators. But it's not like he employed Larry. You know, Larry was arguably the brains behind it.
Yeah.
So if anything, Larry's more responsible for Seinfeld being what it is.
Yeah, because it was a 50-50 venture with Jerry opting to act, you know, in the main part.
Yeah. So it's sort of, you know, the house that Jerry contributed a bit to.
Yeah.
You know, he contributed the driveway.
I reckon it would have been...
Or the bricks or the roof. Yeah,
it would have been nicer if Phyllis said it's the house that Seinfeld the show built.
Yeah.
You know, that would have been better.
I don't think she meant it as an insult, but it could be interpreted as, well, hang on, it's not like Jerry created everything and just brought me on as an employee.
Yeah. She's a bit delusional.
She's a bit delusional, isn't she,
Phyllis?
Yeah, she's... Yeah. They're both a bit...
Kind of in their own world, in a way,
Yeah, they're both a bit weird.
A bit weird. They go to look at the wire in the yard. Cheryl says that they need to sign an agreement so the wire can be buried. Jeff calls Larry's voicemail and complains about having to pay for the fire damage. And they were outside and the voicemail went off inside. It must have been a pretty loud one.
Yeah.
If they could hear it all the way from outside.
Yeah. I mean,
unless it was just done for effect.
Yeah. I mean, I can't remember exactly where the phone is positioned. I'm trying to think back to
it's
last
in the
week.
Kitchen, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I can't remember. I haven't seen enough Curb to have a lay. Like, you know, I know Jerry's apartment from Seinfeld, like the back of my hand, because you see it so much, you kind of get a mental map. With Curb, there's not a lot of shots where you get... I'm sure if you watched it, you could figure out like where things are. Obviously, they've increased the volume of it just for the sake of the scene so that it works when they're outside.
Yeah.
But I think realistically, it wouldn't be... Unless the kitchen is the only thing between the backyard and the answering machine. Sorry, not the kitchen, the lounge room. I'm thinking to last week's episode where the interior decorator, you know, refuses to give Diane Keaton's number.
Yeah.
You know, and Larry's in the kitchen and then there's like a little lounge room and then there's maybe the backyard. So maybe, I don't know.
I think they might have two voicemail machines. I think they got one in the kitchen and the one like in Porno Gill was like in the living, like in one of the living areas.
Yeah.
So he must have like, maybe they're connected somehow.
And
you can check the voicemail on either one.
Yeah.
I don't know. They're linked.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm thinking, you know, if I'm in a different room, like if I'm in my office and my phone's in the lounge room, you can kind of hear it through a closed door, but you don't hear it clearly.
Hmm.
Or, you know, sometimes my partner who works at home will be having a meeting and I'll be in the other room and I can kind of hear muffled voices, but I can't clearly hear what's being said. Not very realistic.
No, it was probably just played more for effect, of course. Jeff calls to complain. Dean overhears it. Oh, sorry. Jeff says that he's complaining about having to pay for the fire damage that the boy caused. Dean overhears it and says that he is a lawyer and happy to help Jeff regarding his situation. Dean says that he is a huge Julia Louis-Dreyfus fan, and he asks Larry if he can meet her. Larry says he'll call her but can't promise anything as she's very busy. He interprets Dean's request as a bargaining tool to have the wire moved, and you can kind of see Larry's, like, he kind of puts the pieces together, and you can kind of see, like, his face shift. You know, when Dean's like, I'll sign, he's kind of implying, I'll sign the wire if you let me meet JLD. So you can see the cogs turning in Larry's brain. He's like, oh God, I've got to get this done so I can get the wire to make Cheryl happy.
Yeah, no, he immediately becomes short and quite rude to them. He's just like, yeah, cool. Like, you know, and when they leave, he's just very openly rude to them.
Mm.
He's already pissed off.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard to say whether Dean deliberately asked to meet Julia Louis-Dreyfus as a bargaining chip. It's, you know, it's sort of can be interpreted both ways.
Yeah.
But yeah, I can understand why Larry's going, well, like, who the fuck is this guy? He's, yeah. I mean, the interaction's been pleasant so far. And all they have to do is sign some papers, like to bury a wire. It's not a big deal. Like, they're not really doing them a favor. Like, if my neighbor came to me and said, hey, can you sign this paperwork to do something to bury a wire? I'd say, yeah, cool. Like, it wouldn't be a thing. I wouldn't need to go over there and see the wire or meet them. Just go, yeah, cool. I'm helping out some random person, my neighbor or whatever. It's such a non-event. But for them, it's like, you know, there's so much to it.
Yeah, and sure, I mean, it might have an effect on your power supply for like half a day.
Yeah.
You know, but you can plan for it.
Yeah.
Like,
if it's going to affect me, I'd want to know, I'd want to be kept in the loop. Like, we're going to have to turn the street's power supply off for half a day to bury it.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Like, just let me know the date and I'll make sure that I'm away that day or whatever.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't have to go over there and meet them and then like leverage that to meet Julia Woodruff. Like, it's just this big thing. It's just like, just sign the paper and piss off.
Because it sounds like the other five couples were fine with it.
Yeah.
Like, they just signed right away, but this one needed a bit of coercing.
Yeah. Now, actually, you know, I said before that it's kind of open to interpretation whether he meets JLD, whether he requests to meet JLD, you know, as a bargaining chip or if it's just a coincidence. My feeling is that he is subtly manipulating Larry.
Oh, yeah. That's what I think, yeah.
Yeah. Like, it's not directly suggested. It's, you know, it can be open to interpretation, but given how much he wants to meet JLD and the fact that he's making this big deal out of just signing a bit of paperwork, he's obviously, you know, playing him a bit.
Yeah, a little bit.
Tell me if I'm going over the line here, but it's always been a dream of mine to meet Julia Louis-Dreyfus and just meet her in person. And if you could just make a phone call and make that happen, that would be so great.
You know what? I'm more than happy to call her up. I can't guarantee.
So it's so hard to get anything absolutely guaranteed.
Exactly.
It's like you want to get something buried, you don't know if it's guaranteed or either.
No.
You don't even know if that's impossible because there's a lot of papers to be signed. I agree with you there.
And we see later on in the evening, Larry and Cheryl are in their bedroom, and Larry says he won't make the deal with Dean. He would rather move first before making the deal. And he's like, what is this guy? Is he a four-year-old? He's going to meet his favorite person.
I believe his words are, fuck him.
Fuck him, yeah. He's really...
It's either fuck him or fuck that guy.
Fuck that, yeah. He goes all out, and he's like, what, is this guy a four-year-old? He's got to meet his hero.
This is the most openly angry we've seen Larry so far
yes.
throughout the series. He's just, you know, he expresses frustration, and he gets a bit worked up. He's like, well, but this is just... I fucking hate this guy.
Oh, yeah.
Fuck him.
Yeah, fuck him. Cheryl asks him to make the call so the wire can be buried. And she says that JLD, like, she kind of softens at Cheryl. She's like, JLD might think that the deal might be funny. You know, she might think it's a bit funny. And then Larry says that he'll call Jeff about all this situation. But Cheryl says that the phone cutoff is 10 p.m. And this is the first time we see the running joke of the phone cutoff,
yeah.
which we'll see a few more times this season. And I think a couple more times in season two.
Yeah, it is a pretty relied upon joke, you know, that's brought up quite a lot is, you know, what is, I mean, it's a typical Larry David thought or idea that, you know, there are certain social protocols and if you break them, then the consequences are huge. They are in this episode.
They are, yeah.
But yeah, it's one of many sort of, you know, Larry David hallmarks in Seinfeld. Just these usually things that people don't think about or care about, or if they do think about it, it's fleeting. But for him, it's like, you know, there's socially established rules that we all have to abide by.
Yeah, examining the minutiae of life.
Exactly.
That's how Seinfeld and Curb roll.
Yeah.
So Cheryl says that the phone cutoff is 10 p.m. Larry insists it's 10:30 p.m. He calls and Susie answers, but we don't hear Susie. It's like one of those scenes where you only hear what Larry's saying. And she says, it's implied that she says it is late and Larry will call again tomorrow. The next day, Jeff and Larry are at a restaurant. They sit down. Jeff says that Susie was pissed that Larry called at 10 p.m. He also says that he is hesitant about continuing to use Dean for his legal issue as he's a bit of a weirdo. He's a freak, he says.
I can imagine, you know, if they met or talked on the phone, Dean would probably bring up the fact that, oh, what's Larry like? You know, he would, any opportunity to grill, you know, Larry or Jeff or anyone associated with Seinfeld, even if it's indirectly associated, he would use that as an opportunity to like to bring up Seinfeld or Jerry or JLD or whatever.
And then Jeff's like, shut the fuck up.
Yeah, Jeff just wants to talk business. You know, he wants to keep the relationship professional. And I can imagine Dean doing that. And then also, you know, at the end of the conversation going, oh, so you're Larry's manager, are you? What's Larry? You know,
yeah.
Just have you ever met Jerry? Like, what's he like?
Or yeah.
What's, you know, just bringing up and you just go, just different alone. Conversation, man. Like,
yeah.
Like, I'm employing you.
Stop. Yeah. That's probably why Jeff isn't happy with
yeah.
you.
Yeah. yeah.
Larry convinces Jeff to keep using him so the wire can be buried. Jeff says that the kid needs to stay at Jeff's house for a couple of days as the camp doesn't want him there. Later on, Julia Louis-Dreyfus and Larry are at Dean's door and they knock. JLD says that she only has 10 minutes to visit as she has errands, you know, picking up the kids from school, because at the time her kids were quite young. Now I think they're in their 20s, like late teens,
yeah.
her boys. So now that they, you know, back then they were young. Phyllis answers the door and she is in tears. You know, she's got tears streaming down her face, her mascara's running down her cheeks, all that kind of jazz. She reveals that her cat died. And Dean is also not at home because he is with Jeff. They sit in the living area to ask where Dean is. Phyllis says that he's with Jeff and he'll be back in about 20-25 minutes. Phyllis is still crying and Julia feels bad for trying to leave. The scene cuts to Phyllis explaining that the cat got caught in a lawnmower. She suggests that she will record them both on a camcorder for Dean. She goes off to get the camcorder. Julia is wondering where the husband is as Larry apologizes profusely. Phyllis returns with the camcorder. She says, or JLD says, she is reluctant to be on camera. Phyllis turns the camera to Larry. Larry says that Jerry Seinfeld is a eunuch as a joke because Phyllis asks what's Jerry like.
Yeah,
so obviously she's a freak like Dean as well.
Yeah, they're both obsessives.
She's like a fangirl.
Totally.
Seinfeld fangirl.
Yeah, and just totally takes advantage of the fact that Larry's their neighbor and just, you know, oversteps that boundary.
Yeah.
You know, like if Larry David was my neighbor, it would be hard for me to not bring up Seinfeld being a Seinfeld fan, but I wouldn't do it at every interaction and every opportunity.
Hmm.
You know, like they're just going too far.
Yeah, too far.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I could imagine, like, if you're Larry, you don't want to talk about Seinfeld all the time.
No.
I mean, you've done other shit.
I mean, you've got to expect that people will want to ask you about it because it's such a monumental thing.
Oh, and yeah. It was part of the zeitgeist in the 90s.
Yeah. And I mean, it was his whole life, you know, for 8 years up until a year or two before, or 2 or 3 years before Curb started in 2000, like in real time. So it's a recent significant part of his history.
Yeah.
And it's what made him rich and famous. So naturally people are going to want to talk about it, but you know, there's a limit, you know, like if we were friends and you did something huge in your life that I was a fan of, I'd bring it up occasionally.
Oh yeah.
Because it is part of your life. You can't ignore it.
I'd be happy to talk about it.
But I wouldn't bring it up on every interaction and be like, oh, so what's Jerry up to? You know, did you talk to Michael Richards last week? You know, it's just, it's punishing and offensive.
It's like we get some super fan from like our previous podcast, Big Lebowski. So what's Ivan and Steven like? Bidwabask. Is it still on?
Don't think that'll happen.
No, I don't think that'll ever happen. Unless if we do something groundbreaking, like a documentary podcast or something.
And don't think that'll happen.
Don't think that'll happen either. Nah, it's fine. Actually, I'd rather that. I'd rather not be too famous. You know, because you get people asking, how's the podcast?
Yeah.
Well, I like the podcast, but they don't ask you 1,000 questions about it.
No, it's usually just polite conversation. Like, you know, you see a mate and you're like, oh, how's that thing that you were doing that you told me about last time going? Yeah. Like, you don't really care about it. It's just like, you know, it's just checking in with whatever means something to your friends.
Exactly. But anyway, as I was saying, Phyllis asked about Jerry to Larry, and Larry says as a joke that Jerry is actually a eunuch.
Yeah, I think he says that at 13 he joined a choir, like a Jewish choir.
Yeah.
You know, and he had his testicles removed.
That's right.
And then she asked JLD, you know, is that true? What's Jerry like?
And she's
like, I have no fucking idea.
Yeah, I love that. She just lets loose. She's like, I don't have no fucking idea. Larry says that he will call Jeff to get Dean back home quickly. He calls Jeff and says that Dean is still with him as he hangs up quickly. Phyllis shows Julia some antique bracelets that she sells and she wants to buy one off her. And one of them happens to be the bracelet from the episode of the same name from 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, another one of the many coincidences.
Mm-hmm, indeed.
Oh, God. Oh, this is good. This is good. This is good. Hi, Julia. Talk. You know, I don't mean to be a party pooper, but I'm not really crazy about those camcorders.
No.
You want to ask Larry something on the machine?
Okay, just let me get... Okay. Tell me about Jerry Seinfeld, and tell me about, he dates those young girls.
He's a eunuch.
He's a eunuch?
Yes. His testicles were cut off when he was about 13 because he was in the Beth Shalom choir. And that's when he wanted to be a choir. He was a choir boy.
Julia, is that true? Does he really have no testicles?
You know, I gotta tell you, I don't have any fucking idea.
Later on, Cheryl suggests that Larry should get JLD to get her back at their house. He refuses as he doesn't want to impose on his friendship with Julia. Larry looks around for his notepad as he's lost it. He remembers that he went to Julia's house and that he may have left it in her kitchen. Larry calls Julia to ask if he can go to get the pad from her house. And mind you, this is late in the evening, so the phone cut-off time thing happens again.
Yeah.
Yeah. But Julia, because he goes, oh, look, it's before 10 o'clock. I'm going to give it a go. 10 to 10. Julia says that it's too late to call. Her cutoff is 9:30 p.m. Yeah. And it makes sense because she has kids, young children at the time. So
I think the point is that, you know, Larry, a lot of Larry's understanding of the world is very rigid, that, you know, this is either appropriate or inappropriate. He doesn't have a lot of room in the way he thinks and the way he views the world for different people have different ideas about the same thing.
Yeah.
You know, JLD and is it D? No. What's her husband's name?
Brad Hall.
Brad.
Yeah.
You know, their cutoff is 9:30 p.m. Jeff and Susie's is 10 p.m. Larry and Cheryl's might be 11 p.m. Other people's might, you know, everyone's got different, you know, Larry always tries to define how the world should be in very simple terms.
Like, oh, yeah.
This is the way it is for everyone. And if you deviate from that, or if there's a difference of opinion in that, they're wrong.
Yeah, he looks at stuff from a micro level.
Yeah.
And he's like, all right, these are the machinations of life.
Yeah, he's not very good at being flexible or, you know, amenable to just, you know, different people's, you know, ideas about things.
He's extremely rigid with his routine.
Yeah.
That evening, later on, Larry enters Julia's house to go look for the pad. She says that it's not at their house. Julia's husband, Brad, goes to the door as Larry lets himself in to have a look. He apologizes about the phone cutoff time. He's searching through the cupboards in the kitchen. He goes to the patio as the couple behind his back are frustrated with what he's doing. She's like, God, we got to get this guy out of the house.
Yeah.
Larry realizes that the pad could be in Brad's office as he had to make a phone call in there earlier in the day. He says that it's not there. As Larry searches through all the way through Brad's furniture, rummages under his couch, in his desk drawers. I mean, that's very rude.
Yeah, to just walk in there, especially, you know, when the kids are asleep, it's after their cutoff time. You know, they're obviously getting ready for bed. They're in their pajamas.
Yeah.
JLD's in a robe. You know, and it's just an awkward, you know, it's probably like a Tuesday night or something at 10 p.m. And even though Larry and JLD are friends, if someone rocked up to my house at that time, fair enough if they're desperate to get their thing back, you want to help them out. But if they just barged in and just started searching through my house, I'd be like, what are you doing, man?
Yeah,
like,
that's ridiculous.
Yeah,
do
like,
that.
You know, I'll look for it for you. And if I find it, I'll return it to you tomorrow.
Yeah.
You know, or whatever. But don't just come in and make yourself at home.
I was expecting Larry to, like, accidentally reveal something in Brad's drawers, like a porno magazine or condoms or like something sex, like something to do with sex or, you know, something like raunchy.
Yep.
Like I thought Larry would uncover something and then they'd realize it, but they probably because Julia and Brad are playing themselves.
Yep.
They don't want to deviate too far from the self-deprecating.
Yeah.
Maybe. That's my guess. I thought he'd like unlock something.
No, that's a typical Curb play where accidentally things just like,
things get
accidentally
uncovered.
Accidentally embarrassing things just happen.
Yeah.
From, you know, just normal stuff.
Yeah, yeah. I thought something might have come from it, like looking in Brad's office, but no, that's fine.
I think the scene was awkward enough.
Yeah, it was.
Larry sort of just like barging his way in and rifling through the house and then just going like, what the hell?
And then when I open up another can of worms, which they have to like wrap up the subplot for.
Yeah, the story's already got a lot of moving parts.
It sure does. Their son Bobby wakes up as Larry asks if he found the notepad. Larry asks Bobby if he found the notepad.
Yeah, and the kid is like half asleep and confused. Yeah. He's like, what? Who's this guy?
And eventually they both kick Larry out of the house, Julia and Brad. Julia tells Brad that she will call Jerry Seinfeld to tell him what happened. She's like, I'm calling Jerry. What's the cutoff in New York? Yeah. I got no idea. I'm going to call Jerry Seinfeld and explain. She's really angry at this point.
Yeah, so even they are worried about the cutoff.
Yeah, they're really worried about the cutoff. and they're like, no, I got to call Jerry. Yeah, I wonder what Jerry would do, though.
Don't know. She probably just wanted to say, you know, Larry just did this thing. You know, like sometimes it's like if you find out a piece of gossip, you have this impulse to share. You're like, oh, I want to tell someone about that thing I just heard about. Or like, you know, oh, my friend just did this crazy thing. Like, I don't know. That's all I think it is.
Yeah, fair enough.
She just wanted to talk to her friend about their former kind of boss and business partner acting crazy.
And New York was at least 3 hours ahead.
Yeah.
So it's probably would have been hard. In the next scene, Larry enters Jeff's house to get him to play a golf simulator. So he's picking him up to take him to the golf simulator, Larry says later on, where the house has been ransacked. Susie is blaming Jeff for bringing the kid home as she turns her fury towards Larry when he walks in the door. This is the first time I think we see Susie in all her fury.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is like the start of what we see later on.
Yeah. I think we mentioned in episode 1 or 2, Susie is kind of suggested that she doesn't really like Larry and that she's quite an angry person.
Well, in the Pan's Tent, the first episode, she's actually quite calm. I mean, the parents are there. She takes them to go see the kids upstairs.
That's true.
Yeah. I mean, she probably has that fury underneath, but she kind of hides it quite well.
This is the first time it's on full display.
It's on full display, and she's calling Jeff a fat fuck, useless,
a loser.
All the pejoratives that she uses later on in the series to call Jeff. You know, she's like, you're useless father, you know, that kind of shit.
Yeah, I mean, if she really thought, if I thought that my partner was all of those things all the time, like, why am I with this person?
Yeah, exactly. Probably, I don't know, there could be an underlying reason. We might have mentioned it in a later episode, why she's with him. Maybe, I don't know. Listen to those. If you're on Patreon, you can listen to them right now as of the recording of this episode, but otherwise you gotta wait.
Yeah.
Yeah. Susie says that lots of her valuables have been stolen. Jeff says that he will get all the stuff back. Susie berates Larry for calling after their cutoff time. She says, I had to have a Valium or a Xanax. I couldn't sleep.
Was it
a Xanax?
No, it was not a Xanax. It was the one that makes you hallucinate. Ambien.
Oh, was it Ambien?
I think she said Ambien.
I thought she said Xanax.
Maybe she said Xanax.
I thought it was Xanax.
I don't know.
Yeah, yeah. No, she said she had to take something of that nature and help her sleep. You know, she was really wound up from the call.
Yeah.
Yeah, really.
And she also says to Larry that she struggles to sleep anyway.
She does. So that kind of, that threw her off the rails. She says to Susie that her grandmother's brooch that she brought over from Russia, she can't find it. And she can't find it, she will lose her shit even more. She comes back a minute or two later and she berates Jeff and Larry because that's missing too. Jeff and Susie walk off because Jeff promises to find everything and he goes upstairs. Larry is just sitting there in bewilderment. Back at home, Cheryl says that she found the bracelet that she wanted at the same store Larry went to when he fought Richard Lewis. Because so we find out in the episode, Richard ended up getting the bracelet.
Yeah.
So even though Larry bundled Richard out of the front door, Larry got there first. Maybe they didn't.
Well, in that last scene, he was refused service, even though he won the fight because of the fight. They were like, well, you know, you might have gotten here first, but you're still fighting in our foyer.
Yeah.
Piss off.
And then eventually Richard would have come past and got the bracelet.
I mean, maybe Larry walked away and Richard got the sale out of sympathy.
Like, yeah.
Oh, this random guy beat you up. Yeah, of course you can have the bracelet.
Yeah, maybe something like that.
You know, or he came back an hour later or he got someone else to buy it. I don't know.
Yeah, yeah. But we find that out in this scene.
Yeah.
That Richard, we find out that Richard got the bracelet
yep.
and Larry didn't. Cheryl says that she found the bracelet she wanted wanted at the same store Larry went to, like I said. Cheryl leaves and Larry puts the bracelet on the dresser. You know, very nonchalantly, just puts it there and we expect nothing, but something happens later on. Julia arrives a few hours later at Larry's house. Larry apologizes about his behavior the other night at her house. She asks Larry if she found her bracelet as she lost it. So remember, the bracelet that Cheryl has is the same one JLD got,
yep.
But JLD got it from Phyllis. So we got to factor that in.
There's a lot of copies of this bracelet.
Yeah, and there must
JLD
be.
JLD has one, Cheryl has one.
There must be knockoffs or something.
What's Richard's girlfriend's name?
Oh, Sophia.
Sophia, mm. She has one. Yeah, there's a lot of them around.
Yeah. Anyway, she's going to turn around and the dresser, I forgot to mention, is at the front door. So Larry left it there. She mistakes Cheryl's bracelet that she sees on the dresser for hers and takes it. And she goes, Larry, why would you steal the bracelet? And Larry's like, no, I know this looks really bad, but it's not what it looks like. She takes it and walks off. God. Oh, no, she's about to walk off, rather. Dean arrives as JLD's about to leave, and he is awestruck by seeing her, saying she's a big fan, he's a big fan and all that stuff. She gets angry at him for not keeping their appointment, and she says, when you have an appointment, stick with it.
Yeah.
Like, that's the rule. I'm a busy person. I got shit to do.
Yeah.
I don't have time for all this crap. And she walks out the door. Dean is disappointed as Larry says that JLD is angry at him rather than Dean, because obviously he's trying to get that wire buried for Cheryl, so he's still trying to be on the good side.
He's trying to convince him that this counts. This, to me, like the back and forth, I know it's a bit more ad-libbed than Seinfeld. Seinfeld was a lot more scripted.
Yeah.
But the back and forth, I can imagine Jerry and George having this, or Jerry and someone, like where Jerry's trying to get something out of someone and he's trying to convince him, like, no, it was still technically an interaction. And the guy's like, well, you know, I'm a lawyer.
That was more of an encounter.
It was more of an encounter.
yeah.
You know, there's a delineation there, blah, blah, blah. Like Larry's dialogue is very curb and Jerry's is usually more precise and sharp and witty.
Sure.
But just this particular interaction was, for me, very, very Seinfeldy. I can imagine Jerry and George or Jerry and someone having this sort of interaction where, you know, they're trying to define something very specific, but they're just like, you know, they're disagreeing.
They're disagreeing, yeah. And, you know, Dean says that doesn't count, blah, blah, blah. He says that it was a terrible encounter. They disagree over whether it was an encounter or a meeting. Larry tells him to leave. He basically says, get out of my house. That's it. Dean walks out the door and he comes back through the front door and he says, by the way, I found your brown notepad. It was hidden under a cushion on my couch. And he goes to the front page and he says, actually, it said on the front page that you'll offer a $500 reward if it went missing. And Larry says, fine, he'll draw up the check.
Yep.
So he walks over to give him a $500 check.
He says my favorite line of the episode in this scene. He says something like, oh, what is it? Like, yeah, just wait here, Sherlock. Wait here, Sherlock, and I'll go get the check.
Go get that check. He's like, fuck this. I'm down $500.
Yeah.
Cheryl's bracelet was taken by Julia. How am I going to explain this to Cheryl?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. He's still got to figure out another, like, to satisfy Dean's expectation of interacting with JLD to get the wire signed.
Yeah.
You know, it's another episode where it all just goes on. Wrong.
Goes to shit. And just before the credits roll, the Davids are sitting in their backyard as the wire is still hanging over their head.
Yep.
So it sounds like it was unsuccessful.
Yeah.
So they'll never get Dean and Phyllis on board. That's
I don't
it.
Think so.
Nah.
No. I think they could. I think I could imagine a scene where, or, you know, conversations afterwards where Cheryl's like, well, you just have to keep trying with JLD. Like, I'm determined to get this wire buried. Just keep trying. Figure it out. Apologize to her. Smooth it over. Make it look like an accidental run in. Like, oh, you were with JLD and Dean just happened to be there. Whatever you need to do. Like, I can imagine Cheryl just being insistent and insistent. And Larry just going, you know what? I fucking hate Dean. I gave him $500.
I'm not going to do this shit.
Fuck him.
Fuck him.
And just standing up for himself.
Yep.
And then them just going, well, it's an unstoppable force meets an immovable object.
Yeah.
That's it.
But they eventually, in season two, they move house because of the wire.
Yeah.
So they get another house anyway. Yeah. So it's all for out. It'd be all for naught if he tried.
Yeah. I mean, Larry saying he'd rather move kind of comes true.
It does come true.
You know, he has to move.
In the season two premiere, they move into the house.
Yeah.
And because of the wire, would you believe?
At that stage, I'd just forge Dean and
fuck Dean's signature.
I just go, fuck this. All of this bullshit is not worth it. I'm just going to forge a signature.
Commit a criminal act.
Oh, who cares?
Who cares? The courts will care. And he's a lawyer, Dean.
Oh,
he'll cop it.
Fuck him.
Fuck him.
I just accuse him of being, you know, harassing me and being a stalker.
Yeah, right. Because,
you know, I just throw it back on him.
He's one step away from like a stalker fanboy.
Yeah, kind of.
A simp, if you will. These days he'd be a simp for JLD.
Yeah, Punisher.
Punisher, yeah. That's the end of the episode. Now, out of five Larrys, what do you give this one?
I really like this episode. I give it 4.
Me too. I give it 4. I liked it too. I think it was great. It was wonderful that Julia was in the episode, the first main Seinfeld character or Seinfeld actor, actress to be in the show. Mainline one, I should say. say. Yep. And yeah, it was great. I mean, the writing was really good. It established the fact that, you know, the Wire will never, like, they know, like, they're content in the fact that the Wire will never get buried. And that kind of sets off movements in season two to move house.
Yeah, it sets up a lot.
It was very well written. I like it. Like, there was a lot of really good coincidences.
Yeah.
And with the bracelet and stuff. And yeah, it all worked really well.
Yep. Yep. There are no good coincidences or bad coincidences. There are just coincidences.
They're just coincidences. That sounds like a Jerry line.
Yeah. No,
they're just coincidences.
It's Rava in the statue.
The statue.
There's no good coincidences or bad coincidences. They're just coincidences.
And she's smoking in the elevator.
Yeah, in the elevator. And then she wants to get the other elevator attendees. Is that the word? Lift goers, whatever you want.
Lifties.
On side. She appeals to them and they're just like. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they're trying to get the smoke out of their face.
There are just coincidences.
She's one of your favorites. Secondaries from Seinfeld, one-off ones.
She's great.
Yeah, for sure. Anyway, that was Curbcast. Thank you so much for listening. You can find this podcast wherever you get your podcasts, Apple, Spotify, yada, yada, yada. You can also find us on social media at Curbcast Pod. Just punch that handle in any social media platform, mainline one anyway, and you'll find us.
Yep, that's right. And you can support us by rating or reviewing us on your podcast app of choice. That'd be awesome. And we do have a Patreon as well. For about $5 a month, you can get access to our episodes a week early. And all sorts of goodies that we've done with our previous podcast, But I Don't Want to Be a Secondary Character, and season 2 and 3 of Curbcast.
As well as future projects on the Mishmash Media Network.
That's right.
Indeed. Next week, we are talking about AMCO, episode 7 of season 1. My name's Ivan.
And I'm Stephen.
You take care of yourselves and each other. See you then. Thanks for listening. This podcast is part of Mishmash Media, an independent podcast network. Follow us on social media at Mishmash Media AU or support us on Patreon. All those links are in the show notes.